Hey guys, welcome to the Days in the Wild Big Game Hunting Podcast. Just want to talk to you a little bit before we jump into this next episode. You heard me say it a million times. Please give us a review on iTunes. Helps me keep this free. Also, go check out Phoenix Shooting Bags. Make an amazing product. Even if you're not a rifle hunter, pick up one of their glassing pads. You will thank me for it later. And I'm happy to announce our partnership with Primos and Bushnell. I've been using the Primos Hyperdome single reed. It's a great cow call. And I used a Hyperdome mini to make calf sounds. And if you listen to my podcast with Joel Turner, you'll know how important it is to have that in your bag of tricks to be able to make calf sounds. Bushnell makes awesome trail cameras. And if you go back and you look at my blog back in 2013 and in 2015, I did independent tests on trail cameras and Bushnell came up out on top both times. This season, behind the scenes, I did another trail camera test on a few different brands and Bushnell rose to the top again in bang for the buck, quality, and overall usability. So we decided to partner up with them. And the great thing about that is I'm going to pass along a discount to you guys. You can save 15% if you go to their website and use promo code STL02. That's STL02. Save 15% on anything. Doesn't have to be the things that I use. We use their ground blinds, a couple of their elk calls, and we use the trophy cam. It's an excellent product. Go check them out. I also want to talk to you a little bit about, I know it seems early in the season, but if you don't already know, if you've been listening to the podcast for a while, you know that I am an outfitter here in Arizona and I do run hunts in South Dakota. My busiest time of year is archery deer season here in Arizona. We take out just a handful of, I'm busy because I only take out a select few amount of clients. So if it's something you want to get in on, I have a couple slots left. And I'm telling you this now, early in the season, because people always scramble after they realize that they didn't get enough hunting in for the year or they didn't draw the tags that they want to get in on that hunt. Also, javelina season. The draw is going to be coming up in the next couple of months. I know it seems far away, but it's really not. October is not that far away. And if you want to get in on an excellent hunt, or if you've never been out west or to Arizona and you want to try something new during a time that there's nothing going on, what are you going to do in February? Twiddle your thumbs? Come out. We have amazing hunts. You could do it with a bow. You could do it with a rifle. You could do it with the muzzleloader. Just all around inexpensive, good time, good way to spend the last few months of winter and come out and experience nice weather on a super fun hunt. Get in contact with me. We fill up quick. I take anywhere between 12 to 16 hunters a year on that hunt and the camps fill up really quick. So give us a call. Check out daysinthewild.com. Send me a message. Any way you want to get in contact with me, social media, we'd like to put together a hunt for you. So without further ado, let's jump into this next episode. Hi, welcome to Days in the Wild Big Game Hunting Podcast, brought to you by Phoenix Shooting Bags. Today we are going to talk about elk, and we're talking with Trey Milhone. And Trey's a guide in Colorado. And does a little guiding in Montana as well, but we're going to pick his brain a little bit and listen to some of his stories and some of his experiences and try to dissect some learning tidbits out of that. Going on, Trey?
Not much. How are you this morning, John?
Oh, just stuffing 10 gallons of shit in a 5-gallon hat. So, you know, it's like, every time I feel like I got myself my head above water when something else comes and and piles on me. So right after I'm done with this, I got like three meetings to run to, and just gonna be running around a lot today, taking care of stuff on my other businesses. But
awesome.
It is what it is. I can't complain. Puts food on the table, and my family don't know what it is to struggle. So thanks.
Right.
Thanks to Dad taking care of all that for him. So anyway, so why don't you give us a little rundown about yourself and what you do, and you know, give us a little bio.
Okay. Yeah, I am a Colorado native. I'm born and raised in Vail Valley in Eco County here in Colorado. I've been guiding for around 20 years here in the valley. Cut my teeth guiding on public land, various outfitters around this area and up in the Flat Tops Wilderness of Colorado. I made a kind of a logical transition earlier on to guiding almost exclusively on private land, private ranches here in Colorado, in an attempt to make a living as a hunting guide. I get quite a bit of grief from buddies about it, but I really enjoy doing it.
That's jealousy, man. Because you know, I mean, there's a select few amount of people out there that would argue and probably be completely shun it. But given the opportunity, you handed a guy, say, here's tag number one. This is an all access pass to so-and-so ranch, 40,000 acres private. Here's your public land tag. You know for sure every one of them is going to take that private. But they're going to make you feel bad about it.
You know? They will, yeah. And, you know, like one thing I've learned, I've taken my ego out of it. You know, what other people think of me is none of my business. So I just put my head down and go to work. And I love what I do. And I get to see some beautiful ranches here in Colorado and Montana. And very blessed. I know I'm spoiled rotten, but I sure enjoy it.
Yeah. No, I mean, I guide primarily public land. Say 95% of my guiding is done here in Arizona on public land, but I do some private land guiding in South Dakota.
So okay.
I have a taste of that too, and I know what it's like to have no competition, you know, have a better understanding of the land because the deer don't get pressured and they use the land the same way all the time, where public land, the pressure kind of dictates the way that animals use the land. And it makes for, you know, I mean, you could do improvements to the land and do things that help your hunting and help your, you know, help the herd out. So.
Absolutely. You know,
There's definitely benefits to private land, and I believe me, I love having both. I love being able to just pick up and go and hunt public land anywhere I want here in Arizona and so many other states where I do that. And I know for a lot of guys, private land becomes frustrating because they're sitting on their hilltop in public land and they look over into some, you know, glass over to some guy's private lot and there's, you know, 10 deer or, you know, 5 bulls standing out there or whatever. And they don't have that on there, what they're looking at. And it just becomes frustrating.
Right. No, absolutely. You know, and I feel that frustration. Right. And I've experienced that firsthand. When I hunt for myself personally, I hunt public land. I can't afford, some of these private land hunts. So, I'm a public land hunter myself, but, I just so happen to conduct my business, my guiding work on private land.
Well, it's a more stable platform. And I think you and I were chatting about that before we got on the podcast. It's just having the stability and knowing that you can get a tag for a person, you can kind of control the situation a little bit better. You know, there's a little less unknowns. It just makes for a more quality hunting experience and thus far makes for a better business, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
No, and that's the bottom line for me is, you know, having a successful business, you know, having a wife and 2 kids, I need to know that, you know, consistently I have a certain amount of hunts per year and bringing in an expected amount of income from that.
Yeah. Well, now that we've apologized to everybody for you being able to hunt on private land, why don't you give us a couple of, why don't you give me a story, start off with a story that you learned something about hunting elk that, I don't know, maybe changed the way you hunt them, was an eye-opening experience for you, or something along those lines.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. I think I'll tell you just kind of how I got started, what piqued my interest in elk hunting specifically. I think when I was about 12 or 13 years old, I went on an elk hunt with my brother here on public lands in Colorado. I went with some of his buddies, and I just tagged along for the hunt. It was an archery hunt in September. I remember distinctly it was incredible. We went up some wilderness area here in the White River National Forest, got into a bunch of elk, and it was my first experience being around elk that were just acting like elk. The rut, it was peak rut, bulls were screaming, chasing cows, as if they didn't even know we were there, conducting life as normal. And I was fascinated to see just how these elk interacted, the bugling action, chasing cows. It was incredible. My brother called in a bull for his friend. He shot a bull with his bow at about 25 yards, and the bull, remember, ran right directly at us after he got shot, and my brother and I both had to dive out of the way. The bull ran right in between us, topped over the edge, and piled up in a draw right behind us. And I mean, just the exhilaration, the energy from that hunt, that's what kicked it off for me. Just having that experience is what really piqued my interest in elk hunting, and it's all been downhill since then.
Right. It's kind of hard to top that.
Yeah, never stop chasing that. It's absolutely fascinating for me. I love hunting elk any time of the year that I can, but specifically in the rut is pretty amazing to me still. Just how elk interact, vocalization, everything about them is pretty unique. And I also I enjoy late season hunts, December cow hunts. Anytime I can hunt elk is a great time, but the rut specifically is, I think, what keeps me coming back for more.
What would you say is your go-to tactics? Let's go peak of the rut. You know, things are, bulls are firing off consistently on their own, and you drive up to your hunting spot that morning, you hike into where you need to be. What are you doing from there on out? Like, how are you locating them? What are you doing?
Okay. I don't specifically have a one tactic approach. I think I try to employ more of a stealthy approach to everything that I do. I know a lot of guys really emphasize calling. I'm not the biggest caller in the world. I call when I need to, and I'd say probably 98% of the time that I call, it's typically a cow call. I'm not huge on bugling. I think it is a specific application that works really well on elk, but in my experience, it's really just being stealthy, and oftentimes that's hard to do when you have a client or an inexperienced hunter with you, trying to be stealthy. And that's one thing with private land. It is easy, I would say relatively easy, to just kill a bull. In our attempt, we're not trying to, just kill a bull. We try to identify a specific animal, size, quality, age, and we try to, pinpoint that one specific animal. So it does make it much more challenging when you're trying to harvest one herd bull out of a group of, there may be 15, 20 satellite bulls running around. In a lot of these cases, pretty good satellite bulls, 320, 330 satellite bulls that, you're having to hold these guys back, restrain these hunters from shooting, because you're trying to get that one specific bull. So I use a lot of tools and tactics. I think calling is just one tool in the toolbox for me. Mm-hmm. But me personally, I like to get in as close as possible before I engage in any calling with elk, and always call from cover. And, like I said, I'm a strong proponent in cow calls. And I'm a firm believer in not educating all the elk in the woods. And that's one of the biggest issues I see with public land elk is they've got everyone and their brother calling to them, cow calling, bugling. And a lot of those hunters, many of them, might not be as great as they think they are out in the public land woods, which is fine. But, you know, these elk hear a lot of calls and they get educated. So they become much, much harder to hunt. You know, we hunt these private land elk. They're pretty wild still. You know, they haven't been called to a lot. And it's a challenge. It's just a different type of challenge than public land hunting.
Yeah, no, for sure. You always see that. Like, there's some benefits to... I was just having this conversation, I forgot who it was, a couple of days ago. We were actually talking about mule deer hunting, but this translates real well. Like, I find that in areas, let's say, that have a lot of foot traffic from hikers and campers and whatever, that deer are so used to seeing those humans, smelling those humans, whatever. Yeah, they're going to get bumped and they're going to leave the area, but they come back to that area, like, you know, in the day or 2 days or maybe 3 days, whatever, but they always return. Where I find that, like, if you go to a spot where there's deer and elk or whatever that have never seen a human and you bump them, you probably won't see them for the rest of that hunt.
Right.
So, you know, like, there are some, you know, benefits to having or being in areas that see a lot of high traffic, because the deer and elk or whatever all have gotten used to living with that presence there, you know. Sometimes it makes them smarter and more savvy in how to evade, but also sometimes it just makes them more like less afraid. Oh, I've seen this before. I've seen this, you know, guy walk up a trail this way before and he saw me and he just let me go, you know, kind of situation. And that, and they get educated that way as well. But I definitely see what you're talking about. You know, there's a lot of guys out there throwing out calls and just willy nilly. And then there's guys that know what they're doing. And then there's guys that somewhat know what they're doing. And there's just a lot of information, or, you know, being thrown at these elk, and you don't know what's going through their mind anymore at this point, because they've been confused a lot.
Right. But that is how you learn. I mean, you learn by going out there and playing with elk. And that's, you know, that's the biggest thing I see with guys. You know, a lot of guys want to take the fast track to learning how to elk hunt by, you know, signing up for an elk hunting course, or, you know, watching DVDs or calling videos and tapes. You know, none of those are bad things. But, you know, in my opinion, the best way to learn how to elk hunt is just go out in the woods and get lost and learn how elk behave. And, you know, call to them, you know, and see how elk and interact.
And I'm going to play devil's advocate, because that's easy to say from a guy who lives in Colorado, could just go buy an elk tag and has the largest elk herd in the country, you know. But a lot of these guys are not going – they're not going hunting out of state. So if you're in a draw state, like here in Arizona or Utah or whatever, and it takes you 10 years, even 5 years, 6 years, whatever, to draw a tag, you know, it's tough to do that. So
absolutely.
And I know a suggestion I've always made in the past was go elk hunting with your friends. Your friend draws a tag, take the week off and go elk hunting with him. Get the experience from, even though it's not your tag, go with them. You know, you got to do that in these states that you can't go elk hunting. But it's also nice to have, like you said, have those learning curves shortened a bit with the, you know, DVDs and courses and you know, podcasts like mine and whatever. But
absolutely.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, we definitely have a leg up on most hunters, you know, living here in Colorado. Just the ability to go out every year, buy an over-the-counter archery tag and just go hunt and have a month to do it. And, you know, we're pretty lucky in that regard.
Right, for sure. So I'm going to back up. You said you don't like to hunt, but you like to get in close and you prefer stealth. So let's talk about that. How are you finding elk, and like, what are some of the things you're doing to get to that point, basically?
Okay. I think it depends on the time of the rut going, you know, in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
If we're in pre-rut, I'm not looking for cows. We know, you know, especially on these private lands, we know where cows are pretty consistently. Finding these bigger bulls, I tend to look elsewhere, kind of inconspicuous places. Sometimes it's way up in the high country, sometimes way down low. And I'll try to get on these bulls pre-rut, you know, that are still, they're just right out of velvet. Rut hasn't really begun. They don't have a whole lot of interest in cows. I think calling does have an application that time of the year. Certainly you can call bulls in, but that's really when I try to employ a lot of stealth, getting in on bulls that are still bachelored up, that don't have a whole lot of interest in cows yet. And then as we gradually transition into the rut, it seems like all of our tactics change a little bit and we adapt to how these elk are interacting, what bulls are coming into these cows.
Mm-hmm.
As these cows start to ramp up and more cows come into estrus, typically bigger bulls start to come in and show up and find new bulls every day. And that's when I'll start calling a little bit more and we start targeting more hunting around cows. And while we're in the peak of the rut, we want to be in the midst of those cows every day, as close as we can, always mindful of wind. And yeah.
So let me ask you this. You mentioned looking for, you know, bachelored elk, bachelored bulls up. Excuse me, my brain's up, not working very good this morning. You're looking for bachelor bulls and, you know, before in that pre-rut stages. What kind of terrain are, well, let me ask you this. Are you glassing for them? Are you in a place where you can glass for them? Or are we talking, you know, thick timber that, you know, not glassable?
Most of it is glassing. I mean, you know, optics are the most valuable tool I have in my kit. I use, you know, high quality optics, mm-hmm. binoculars and spotting scope. We try to get on these vantage points and glass, and try to take an inventory of everything that's out there and then make a move on it. If it's something, you know, that we're interested in pursuing, then we'll make a move on them, come up with a game plan. Last year, I spent 5.5 days on one bull just trying to figure out how to get in there. He was in a very hard to get to spot because of the wind and exposure and the open face that I would constantly find him on. And, mm-hmm. You know, but that's a nice thing when we have these guided hunts, we have a time constraint, but it's typically 5, 6, 7 days. And
right.
We can hunt smart, you know, knowing that no one else is going to be in there to booger that elk out of there.
He's
not going to be blown out of the country by another hunter coming in or someone driving through there with a four wheeler. You know, certainly a mountain lion or something could ding them out of the country. But, you know, if we hunt these elk smart, we can be pretty non-invasive with our tactics and not blow them out of the country, not educate them a whole lot, sneak in, get our business done, and get out of there.
Awesome. So what types of terrain features or landscape features, topography, vegetation, are you typically finding bulls in that pre-rut? Is there like a correlation, or are you just finding them pretty much everywhere?
We're finding them pretty much anywhere. We have noticed the specific area that I'm at in southern Colorado. While these elk are in the velvet, they tend to hang above timberline. I think just getting out of the heat, getting out of the bugs, we'll catch these bulls up on these open ridge lines, you know, at 12, 13,000 feet where they can stay cool. And sometime around, you know, early August, August 10th, we find that these bulls will come down into the timber, start stripping that velvet. And from that point, it's just a hide and go seek game. These bulls will be anywhere. I've caught them down in the low country, sagebrush, oak brush country, you know, and it all depends on feed. Last year was a pretty decent moisture year, This year is a different story. And, well, really all across Colorado, Southern Colorado is experiencing a pretty tough drought. So I think, we're going to be really pinpointing some of those areas that did get moisture, you know, and it's pretty transparent right now to see where, you know, rainstorm came through and greened up one portion of property versus another, or some of those low areas where there's a wet spot or a spring or a weep, where there's a little bit of feed. I think that's probably where we're going to be finding bulls this fall. Mm-hmm. Just where there's some green forage.
So it sounds like keying in on the feed is a really good tactic and a good way to locate, because they're tied to it. Yep. And it's not found everywhere.
Okay. Right. Because their motivation that time of the year, if it's not cows, it's feed. You know, those bulls they're tanking up, getting ready for the rut. I love hunting them that time of the year, right when they're straight out of velvet, white antlers, big fat grass bellies and slick coats. It's just kind of almost like hunting a different animal. Their behaviors are a lot different.
Yeah. How would you say it differs from?
Well, their motivation, like I said, their motivation isn't cows. So they're not on the hunt looking for a girlfriend. They're not on the fight with other bulls. It's when, you know, you can see a group of bulls together, 5, 8, 10 bulls all together, where, you know, oftentimes some of those great big bulls I'll find early on, and then come rut, oftentimes they disappear and I won't see those bulls ever again, the ones that I saw pre-rut early on. So in my experience, some of the bigger bulls that I've found or come across have been pre-rut early on.
Nice. Yeah, a buddy of mine, Ryan Carter, he prefers that pre-rut stuff also, because he feels like he can pattern bigger bulls, and once the rut starts, it's too chaotic to really, you know, pinpoint where these bigger bulls are at and what they're doing.
Absolutely. That guy certainly knows how to do it.
Yeah, he's definitely got it down. He's definitely got it down.
Absolutely.
Well, he treats them like whitetail, you know, runs a lot of cameras, does a lot of, you know, patterning. And that makes sense why he likes them when they're still on their patterns, because as soon as they go off their patterns, they become hard, you know.
And that's one thing I started to do this year, employ some game cameras, really just out of curiosity, see what was out there. We've got a couple dozen cameras set up here. It's been really, really fun for me to watch. Probably one of the most revealing pieces is knowing and understanding how many predators are on the landscape, you know, living amongst these elk. We're finding quite a few mountain lions, bears, and obviously looking at a lot of deer and elk, but it's pretty neat to see what's out there that you normally wouldn't see on any given day out in the woods.
Yeah, it's crazy, right? Yeah. And you realize when you see that why they're as skittish as they are, because they're literally having to, you know, watch for predators every day of their lives, 24 hours a day. So, yeah. When you get in close and you start using your cow calls, what's your kind of like, do you have a go-to, or do you just kind of feel the situation out? What are you doing?
I feel the situation out, take the temperature of the bull, what stage of the rut we're in, how these elk are reacting. Oftentimes, one factor we have is we do have a, you know, high density of elk when the rut's going on. And the bull to cow ratio is pretty unique where we are. And oftentimes we'll have, one of the biggest issues is having too many satellite bulls around. So when I call, you know, I'll always try to sneak in there as close as I possibly can, get my hunter in place, and then I'll back out of there where I'm mobile from cover and I can move around and cow call. And more often than not, you know, consequently, we do call in quite a few satellite bulls in the process, but occasionally it does work that we'll be able to call one of those herd bulls off of his cows. And I will challenge bull, I'll bugle, try to get a bull activated and get him, you know, peel away from his cows even briefly, And that's why, you know, we tried to sneak in there and get a hunter set up. So that kind of limits what we can do, because once you plant a hunter, then you're somewhat limited to that setup and that situation. Those elk start moving, I'll grab a hunter, try to peel off and get ahead of them. These elk, you know, if they're on their way to bed, heading to bed, we'll always mindful of when, try to get around these elk, get ahead of them, and call from there.
Awesome. So you mentioned, obviously, that you like to get in as close as possible. How far away is too far away for you to start a calling sequence?
I think anything outside of 80 or 100 yards is too far. I try to get in within that close before I start calling. And, you know, it all depends on the topography, the cover, you know, how close we can get to those elk oftentimes. And if it doesn't work, we come back the next day and try it again. Gotcha. These elk, that is one of the luxuries of private land. We don't have to push it every time like you would on public land. If you have, you know, public land, if you have an opportunity on a great bull, you're going to go for it, because there's no telling what's going to happen to that elk if he's even going to stay in the country.
Right, right.
You have to be pretty committed to public land bulls when you have that opportunity. Private land, we do have the luxury of backing out of there and letting things calm down, going back in there next day and trying it again.
Yeah, no, for sure. So you mentioned a little bit ago about, you know, how elk, they got a schedule. They're going to be heading back to bed, or they headed to feed or whatever. Where do you find, you know, this, or as a rule of thumb, where do you like to find them the best at? Where they're feeding in the morning, or you like to find them right where they're, you know, about to bed down, or like, what's your...
Right. I try to catch them in that transition zone. Oftentimes we'll find them here on these big open faces or open parks, you know, in the evenings feeding. In the mornings, they're heading back to timber. And I try to catch them in that transition zone. Being on private land, some of these private ranches, it is kind of a golden rule that we don't go into bedding areas unless we absolutely need to. That's their turf. And once they get into their bedding area, that's their safety zone. That's home base. So we'd really try to stay out of bedding areas.
Mm-hmm.
I'll catch them, try to catch them as they're heading back to bed. And conversely, in the evenings, I'll try to get on that timber line, those tree lines. And, you know, provided the wind is right, wait for those bulls to start coming out of the woodwork. Literally, you know, watching those bulls come out chasing cows, I'd say if I had to choose, I'd prefer morning hunts.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed to be a little bit more effective, and they seem to be a little more patternable. When we hit a certain time, those elk start going to bed, trying to get around them. And our wind typically is a little more consistent here in the mountains. We know that as things start heating up, those thermals are going to change, wind's going to switch. In the evenings, a lot of times we'll have shifty winds until, just 30, 45 minutes before dark, and that doesn't leave you a whole lot of time to get in position, make a move on these elk. So there's a little more forgiveness on those morning hunts on what we're able to do.
I agree. I think that's a same thing here in the mountains. Actually, you know what? I kind of see that in the afternoons too. Or in the desert, I have the same, where the morning just seems to be better, you know, as far as wind is concerned. So let me ask you this, being that you hunt for yourself personally on public land and you don't have your, you know, golden rule for going into a bedding area, is that something that you'll do when you're hunting public land, or are you still kind of, you know, just trying to catch them going to bed or coming out of bed?
I think I definitely will be a lot more aggressive on public lands, depending on where I'm at. If I'm deep in some backcountry and there's not a lot of guys around, I think I might hunt it a little more conservatively versus if I'm hunting close to home. You know, I know it's a high traffic area. I know there's other camps around, other guys hunting. I might be a little bit more aggressive and sneak into bedding areas. And it is a tactic that does work you can certainly sneak in. I've seen some great hunters. Tyler Johnerson up in Montana, he's one of the best elk hunters I know. I've seen him sneak in on bulls in their bed and get it done. It works, but it's not something, you know, on private land we typically like to do because we don't want to blow those elk out of there. That's their safety zone. Public land, yeah, these elk tend to bed in a little bit thicker, nastier cover. And yeah, I think I'll push it a little bit further on my personal hunts on public land.
Cool. So not to be a dead horse. So just going back to the afternoon hunt, are you trying to, let's say if you don't have a play in the morning or you can't, you know, you're not going to get there in time. What are you, you're watching these elk go into their bedding area and then you're kind of setting up in the afternoon as an ambush, knowing that they're going to come back out and feed on a certain, you know, or come back to the same area that they were feeding in the morning, or do you find that they go?
They absolutely. No.
Yeah.
I'll get in the general vicinity, and in the evenings, I'll usually hang back a little bit further and observe, figure out where these elk are coming out, where they're going to move to, and kind of take a temperature on the evening hunt and just be mobile from there. But I don't want to get in really tight and close. Oftentimes we'll see, you know, in the afternoons, these younger bulls start getting up earlier, you know, then the cows, and then these herd bulls are usually the last ones coming out in the evenings. So it does make for a little bit more challenging of a hunt. And there again, I think the wind is typically our biggest issue, the biggest limiting factor in the evening hunts. And that's one thing. We'll never make a play if we've got bad wind. In my experience, that's one thing you'll never fool an elk's nose.
Right. This kind of brings me to my last question for you, actually. And now I know what you're going to say, but if I gave you three pills, okay, one pill took away an elk's eyesight, the other one took away his hearing, the other one took away his smell, which one would you take?
I'd leave them all. They wouldn't be any fun to hunt if they weren't so hard.
Good answer. But I like that.
they're certainly a challenge, and I love the challenge of it. The smell thing, it can sure get aggravating after, you know, 4 or 5 days of tough wind, you know. But and for us, it's a consistency thing. We have to be able to duplicate it every week. We can't just hope that we go out during, you know, one archery season and kill a bull. We have to attempt to duplicate it every week and try to be successful every hunt. Because
somebody's paying $15,000 for a bull.
Yeah,
there's a lot more pressure on you to get it done.
Right, right. You know, so it depends on us performing and you know, the elk cooperating, and it is really enjoyable on a public land hunt. I personally enjoy my personal hunts because there's very little pressure. And me personally, I could care less if I kill an elk anymore. It's not a big motivator for me. I like to at least get a cow every year, fill the freezer for my family. But hunting for big bulls doesn't get me too excited personally.
Gotcha. Well, I started off asking you early on if you had a good story to share with us. Do you have one that we could close this up with, like a good teaching story?
Yeah. Absolutely. I hunted a bull last fall down in southern Colorado, and he was a real outlier bull. Great, great bull. And I first saw that bull in early September, and I found the bull on public lands. And I watched him from afar. I actually watched a lot of hunters kind of work around this elk, and he seemed to – he went unscathed, was – not dinged or pushed by any of these public land hunters. And I kept an eye on him periodically for a month. And it was 35 days later, I turned him up on one of these private ranches. And it was kind of the tail end of the rut. And he was chasing around a couple cows. And we were able to sneak in there with a really awesome hunter guy that just a blue collar working guy from Texas, saved up his money for years and years and years to do a public land hunt or a private land hunt, pardon me. And he wanted one big bull in his lifetime. He'd done a lot of public land hunts. You know, he was just like you or I, just a regular Joe that, you know, worked his tail off to save up money for this. We were able to sneak in there, and this guy ended up shooting a 391 bull, this bull that I had originally seen on public lands, and we were able to seal the deal and just made this guy's dream come true. And that's probably the most rewarding hunt for me. You know, these guys that they save their pennies, they work hard, and wait a lot of years for something like this to happen. And, you know, that's no small feat, and especially to kill a bull in 390s here in Colorado. That's a pretty unique animal. So it was that last hunt last year was one of the best hunts I've had in years and years. Just because of the rewarding factor, the hunter was deserving of it. He was appreciative, absolutely loved it. And that's why I do it. It's fun for me. The interaction with clients, it's really rewarding.
Awesome. Why don't you let our listeners know where they can check you out? I know you got an Instagram page.
Absolutely, yeah. My Instagram is at Trey Milhoan, TreyMilhoan. And yeah, you can see some of the fun stuff we do. Love elk hunting. Sheep hunting is kind of my weakness. I absolutely love bighorn sheep hunting. And spent a lot of time doing that, a lot of time taking pictures of sheep. And nice. Yeah, folks can find me on there.
Awesome. Well, I want to thank you for coming on and sharing your knowledge with us and sharing a different perspective and being able to see it from both sides, you know, working on private land and hunting for yourself on public. And it's just a very different podcast, which is good because, you know, so many, like you said earlier, there's so many guys out there talking about calling and this and that. And that's fun. Believe me, it's fun. And I get into it a lot. I kind of geek out on that stuff a little bit. But there's a lot to be said about just good woodsmanship and you know, paying attention and learning patterns. And, you know, the guys that have been doing it for years and years and years before we developed calls and whatever, that's the way they did it. And, it's very, very effective, if not the most effective. So,
absolutely, and I will say, at the end, the greatest tools that I've acquired, lessons I've learned, have been on public lands, hunting these, you know, highly educated 3-year-old bulls, and also learning the country at a time before Onyx maps or GPSs. You know, the ability to go out in the woods and get lost, I think, is one thing that is changed a little bit in hunting dynamics nowadays. No one can get lost, you know, access to wherever they want to be is at the touch of their fingertips. So I think that is one important thing for guys to do is I encourage, you know, new hunters, young hunters that are getting into it, leave your phone at home, go out in the woods and learn how to get lost, find your way out, find, you know, learn the elk woods. It just makes you a better hunter in the long run, I think.
Agreed. In my opinion. Agreed. I think a lot of the guys that are kind of like more mine and your age, I'm assuming you're about the same age as me, in the 40s, right?
Or 35.
30, also you're younger than me. You know, we learned how to do the majority of our hunting without that stuff. And now that we have it, it's like, you know, it's really a step up where a lot of the guys just coming into it it's a crutch versus a benefit, or versus a what's the word I'm looking for here? You know, a tool that's going to help them as opposed to relying on it, rather. You know, just a benefit versus a must, I think, is what I'm trying to get at. Yeah.
And they are great tools. If you've got both, if you've got woodsmanship, you know how to survive out in the woods and get around in the woods in the darkness, and you have, you know, Onyx maps, GPS, any of these tools, they're a great combination. But I think all of those, you know, just make up that giant, that toolbox of elk hunting tools that make you successful.
For sure. Awesome, man. Well, thank you for coming on, and good luck to you this season. Maybe we'll get you back on to talk about sheep one of these days.
Be great.
All right, man. Talk to you later.
Thank you, John. Have a good day.
Right, bye.